Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney. Sorry, my machine is not running. Do that again. Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. I have the distinct privilege of being able to welcome back to this program a man whose intellect, whose articulateness, whose clarity about the challenges of our time is, more or less unrivaled. He is a friend as well as a very much admired colleague, obviously, by the name of Benjamin Weingarten. You can find his extraordinarily important outputs at The Federalist, among other places. He is also the author of a terrific book entitled American Ingrate, about the sordid nature and activities at the moment of Ilhan Omar as a progressive, Islamist inside the Democratic Party ranks. Ben, it is great to have you back, especially at a time such as this. Thank you for taking a few minutes to be with us.
Frank, thanks as always for having me and appreciate the kind words.
Well, they're heartfelt and I think deserved. Let me start by asking you about Israel. I know this has been much on your mind as it has mine since the 7th of October in particular, and the horrific attack that took place on that day by Hamas, a designated terrorist organization that at the moment seems to be getting rather the better of Israel as a result, among other things, of the international community's insistence that we have to have extended humanitarian pause in Israel's campaign aimed at ostensibly destroying that entity, that Muslim Brotherhood franchise in Gaza. Your thoughts on what has transpired to date since the 7th of October and where we find ourselves at the moment. We who are committed to the security of the state of Israel we believe it's important to our own.
Well, first, let me just say, if it's not unprecedented, let's call it amazingly atypical that Israel is in a position of routing an enemy that engaged in a mini Holocaust in a single day against it, and yet is forced to effectively resupply the enemy it is destroying, provide it time to recuperate, treat jihadists as essentially equivalent to, granted, I guess, at a 3-to-1 ratio, the innocent Israelis who were kidnapped and have been held in captivity for over 50 days now. So it is asinine on its face that Israel, in the midst of an existential crisis, has to essentially give every possible advantage to the enemy, and of course is being hamstrung, micromanaged, and browbeaten at every turn by the putative ally here, dear ally, America, under the Biden administration. And that gets to the broader point, among many points that we can talk about regarding the Israeli-Arab war before us. The Biden administration's complicity in what transpired has not been emphasized enough, namely its effectively aiding, abetting, and enabling the world's leading state sponsor of jihad in Iran, and the benefits of that accrue to all of its proxies, namely including Hamas as well as Hezbollah on the Northern Front, the Houthis and other proxies. Also benefited Qatar, which harbors Hamas's leaders. The Biden administration in 2021 designated Qatar as a major non-NATO ally, putting it on par doctrinally with Israel, another major non-NATO ally. And since the attack on October 7th, I argued within days that there was quickly coming a bear hug from the Biden administration. And I've pivoted now to saying it's not a bear hug, it's a mauling. And what do I mean by that? In every single respect, the Biden administration has sought to hem in and constrain Israel while paying lip service to somehow countering or checking Iran and its proxies. Those proxies have engaged in dozens of attacks on U.S. assets in the region. The administration has talked about that the day after Hamas is defeated, that the U.S. is going to impose its favored plan on Gaza, not Israel's plan, constraining Israel in terms of its ability to conduct and wage war in Gaza, and who can be attacked and how the attacks can be conducted and the cadence of those attacks. And now this so-called temporary ceasefire, which has the real prospect of being essentially the 15 days to slow the spread, but for Hamas's survival. And so we can talk about in every respect the checking and constraining and the immense pressure the Biden administration has put on Israel to comport itself as Joe Biden so dictates, really as a third term of Barack Obama so dictates, with the leverage of the supply of weapons and supposedly staving off a hostile world, although it's very clear that that hostile world has already shown its true colors. And sadly, and most dangerously, we see how hostile this administration can be. Part of it is ideological. Part of it, of course, is the politics as well of the fact that the marginal voter in Dearborn has disproportionate power over this administration because it dictates whether it survives past 2024.
Well, in the space of 5 minutes or so, you have brilliantly made the case that what is afoot now is not only contrary to American interests, those of people who are committed to Israel, obviously, but also, I think, to the rest of us. And it's important to sort of tease out a couple of these really critical points, if I may. I think 15 days to slow the spread, a reference, of course, to what we were originally told we needed to do to kind of affect a public health response to the COVID crisis, and turned into lockdowns and, you know, closures of churches and all manner of other, abrogations of our freedoms, is a perfect metaphor, it seems to me, to put what's going on now. I wondered if you agree with me, though I can't prove it by any means, but it seems to fit everything that you've said, that what brought this about, what brought about Israel's accession to this idea that they would have a kind of open-ended arrangement as a practical matter to get hostages out by dribs and drabs and give up three times the number of actual jihadis in exchange for these hostages, was affected by the Biden administration quietly, privately, but very directly threatening Israel that it would stop resupplying it with arms it needs to prosecute this war if it did not engage in this kind of humanitarian pause.
Well, to your point, we don't have smoking gun evidence, but we do know that the Biden administration has repeatedly emphasized that Israel has to comport itself according to the laws of war, as if a country that shows more respect for civilians than any other country in the world, civilians who in large part hate its guts and want it destroyed, as if that country is somehow going to be the aggressor and try and kill innocent civilians. We've seen the administration warn Israel not to engage offensively to its north when there are almost 200,000 or maybe more potentially rockets and missiles pointed at it from the north. We've seen the administration talk about the fact that first there has to be delays and delays and delays and resupplying of the enemy with quote unquote humanitarian aid that of course accrues to Hamas's benefit chiefly throughout the engagement. We saw administration officials go and meet with essentially Benjamin Netanyahu's opposition and effectuate a whispering campaign, noting that we're looking forward essentially to the day after Benjamin Netanyahu and that there really ought to be someone else or there will be someone else as prime minister. So look at all those data points combined and how firm the administration is. And then look at this ceasefire effectuated, which on paper, while of course exceptional for the families and their loved ones, is disastrous strategically and tactically. How can we look at it as anything other than, look, the administration has leverage over Israel, and that leverage is in weapons, systems, and arms supplies.
Hold the thought. We'll be right back with more with the great Ben Weingarten right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. A new tanker war has erupted in the waters of the Middle East, with Iranian proxies attacking, seizing, and otherwise targeting vessels in the Red and Arabian Seas. The immediate object of such piracy, ostensibly carried out by Houthi rebels based in Yemen, is to endanger Israel-tied commercial shipping. These attacks, however, fit a pattern of calculated strategic arson being perpetrated elsewhere by Iran's sponsor, Chinese dictator Xi Jinping, as he prepares for a shooting war of his own. Notably, a U.S. destroyer that interrupted one such attack on Sunday subsequently had two Houthi ballistic missiles splashed down in her vicinity. The more our too small navy is tied down half a world away from the Pacific, the better for a man who likely has more such depleting distractions in mind before he moves against Taiwan and us in the months to come. This is Frank Affney. We're back, and I'm very pleased to say we are continuing a really important conversation with one of the people I admire most, Benjamin Weingarten. And Ben, there's so much of what we were just discussing that I want to make sure we double back on a little bit, but particularly this idea that, as you've pointed out, the United States government seems to be, under Joe Biden, which I think you've correctly described as Obama-Biden 3.0, pursuing a policy towards Iran that is treating it far better and enabling it, emboldening it at a time when it is treating our ally, Israel, very badly indeed, and possibly perilously so. What's going on here?
Well, the paradigm that I would describe is that the Biden administration, like the Obama administration before it, is engaged in a maximum pressure campaign against Israel. The converse is that the Trump administration engaged in a maximum pressure campaign against Iran. And that tells you everything you need to know about the nature of the two policies. What we see with the Biden administration's policy right now of preventing Israel from actively defending itself against Iran's proxies in the north, in Hezbollah, the fact that it removed the designation, the terror designation from the Houthis in Yemen early in the presidency, the fact that it refused to enforce sanctions, particularly on oil sales of Iran, refused to snap back sanctions, refused to extend the missile sanctions, did unfroze billions of dollars, and of course, that it did everything it possibly could, bending over backwards to try to get into an Iran deal 2.0, tells you that the Biden administration's policy has been, as the Obama Biden administration's policy was, to make Iran the strong horse in the region, somehow believing that with Iran and its proxies as the dominant powers, that somehow that would lead to the betterment of America's national interests, rather than building on what the Trump administration sought to do, which was build a coalition between Israel and Sunni Arab strongmen, essentially, however distasteful that may be, to provide a counterweight against Islamic supremacists, Sunni and Shia, including, of course, Iran. And so when I look at the post-October 7th policy towards Israel, which follows the policy that preceded it, as you noted, with the snubbing of Benjamin Netanyahu, the siding with the left in Israel, who opposed judicial reforms and other policies of the Netanyahu administration, and essentially sniped at and sought to undermine and hamstring him and continues to do so, I view the post-October 7th Biden policy as a continuation of the status quo. That status quo being constrain Israel, permit Iran to become the strong horse, and we haven't talked about it yet, but I'm sure we will, the two-state solution, so-called, that's been pushed by the Biden administration, which is absurd on its face after you've just suffered the worst attack in modern times, obviously, and probably beyond modern times, from a Palestinian Arab population, which outside of Gaza overwhelmingly supports the savagery and the barbarism that we saw, is just one further indicator of the fact that this is an attempt at the status quo, which is horrible for Israel and horrible for America's national interest. On top of course, the fact that the Biden administration has done everything it can to de-link Iran from Hamas's acts, in spite of reporting from favored publications like the New York Times to the contrary, showing Iran was very clearly involved in the operation that took place on October 7th.
Yeah, no doubt about that. I would argue, as we'll talk about a little bit more with John Mills in our next block, so was China up to its eyeballs in all of this. But to pick up on the point that you've just made, the president has, like a mantra, as have others in his administration, insisted that what will come to pass once all of this brutish business is done, assuming there is any more of it, after all, that what will come next will be a two-state solution, a Palestinian state living side by side in peace with Israel. And what I'm particularly struck by, Ben, is it seems like, again, an example of that classic definition by Albert Einstein of insanity, doing the same thing over again and thinking you'll get different results. Gaza was an experiment in a two-state solution. How did that work out?
Well, quite simply, Hamas was elected and we got the savagery that we saw on October 7th and savagery at various intervals prior to that coming from Hamas. Israel forced its own citizens off of the land, and what transpired was that a terror state was created by Palestinian Arabs. Again, a terror state and a Hamas that supported overwhelmingly and above and beyond the opposition among the Palestinian Arabs. So the notion that you're going to have two states living side by side in peace, we've just seen what transpires when you have quote-unquote democracy, and it leads to jihadism and an existential Islamic supremacist threat from the east, from the west, and from the north. We obviously see this as well in Judea and Samaria, where you have Palestinian Arab forces threatening Israelis, threatening their lives, and there may well be further attacks that are staged from Judea and Samaria in the days and weeks ahead. So the notion that you give Palestinian Arabs who overwhelmingly want Israel destroyed and want total power, a Judenrein Israel from the river to the sea, that that is somehow the chief irritant, as opposed to that the Islamic supremacists are the problem here, is utterly asinine and absurd. The two-state mantra should be laughed out of the room, that that's even a discussion today after what we just saw. And it's worth noting, by the way, that the notion that somehow the Palestinian Authority, Fatah-led, is somehow the moderate alternative to Hamas. Again, overwhelmingly, Fatah has supported the attacks. In some cases, Eugene Kantorovich wrote well at the Wall Street Journal, I think, they were complicit and involved in those attacks. And to your broader point, we've seen this time and time again throughout the history of the Arab aggression against Israelis, which is that Israel engages. There end up being ceasefires that end up only leading to problems festering and growing worse. We see land concessions that only lead to more bloodshed and attacks waged against Israelis. And when it comes to these hostage for jihadi swaps, as we saw on October 7th in the most poignant possible way, one of the thousand traded for Gilad Shalit was the mastermind of the October 7th attack, or at least one of them, in Sinwar. So it is insanity defined. And while Israel is going to be constrained by the U.S., clearly, while Bibi Netanyahu faces threats from the left and probably critics of substantial number on the right as well, in the end, Israel has to pursue its national interest and defend its sovereignty. And so I think that's going to require ultimately making decisions that are going to be challenged and criticized abroad and domestically. But it's better to be feared and loathed than loved and destroyed.
Yeah. The love is a false love, of course, in that case. One last quick point. One of the other factors in all of this, of course, is the rising aggressiveness of the Muslim Brotherhood and other, I call them Sharia supremacists, you call them Islamic supremacists. These are people who are imbued with the idea that they will rule the world. Ben Weingarten, Ilhan Omar is among them. You've written the definitive book on her. Talk very quickly, if you would, 40 seconds or so, about what we've seen in the streets of America and elsewhere around the world in support of this Palestinian jihadism.
Well, I think what it shows us is that the progressive Islamist nexus that I've talked about has borne its poisonous fruit. We see it in the halls of Congress. We see it in the State Department, where we have these dissent cables, temper tantrums thrown by essentially pro-Hamas sympathizers. We see it at our leading lights, educational institutions. We see it among cultural influencers. And as you noted, we see it in the streets as well. This is the poison that has been birthed from our schools, from money that's flowing in from Islamic supremacists in the Middle East, and from the institutional capture, of course, in Washington, D.C., in think tanks and research houses and beyond. So we have been compromised in large part, and it is actually essentially we that are being occupied by an alien worldview than the other way around when the West is called the occupiers.
Amen. Ben, come back with more. We'll talk to you soon. Be right back. Stay tuned.
Night after night, in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Back, and I'm delighted to say we're joined by a great friend and colleague, a member of the Committee on the Present Danger of China, a senior fellow of our Center for Security Policy. You see him on War Room, Pandemic, among other outlets, Newsmax, and of course on this program with regularity. We're always delighted to welcome him back. Colonel John Mills, United States Army retired, especially in the reasonably immediate aftermath of the publication of an important new book by John entitled War Against the Deep State, The Foundations of Mass Surveillance and the Fourth, Fifth, and Sixth Branches of Government. He is also the author of The Nation Will Follow, a personal favorite of mine. John, it's good to have you back, sir. Welcome once again to Securing America.
Frank, thank you so much. An honor to be back with you.
Let me start, John, by asking you about something that we talked about in a group call the other day that, you know, I think you really nailed in terms of both the immediate sort of tactical nature of what's happening, but also the strategic aspects of it. And I'm speaking of what you've described as a new tanker war that is taking place in some of the waters of the Middle East at the moment. Tell us a little bit about it. There's some history there, of course. Who's involved and to what extent are our vital interests at stake?
Yeah, thank you, Frank. Some may forget, during the 80s, kind of the second half of the Reagan presidency, there was a very active shadow war going on. It was called Operation Earnest Will. We reflagged tankers because of the attacks going on in the Gulf by Iran and by Iraq too.
But making there was them also into American flagged vessels, yeah, as I recall.
So they, so they're American flagged, thus they would receive American protection for transit through the Straits of Hormuz and the Persian Gulf. It kind of climaxed with things like Operation Praying Mantis. So there were several furious engagements where American naval and special operators really decimated Iranian naval elements and really taught them a lesson, and things quieted down for a while. It's back. It's going on. I don't think it's being clearly identified and articulated. The Iranians are doing this in a much broader region, and it's clearly they're doing this as the next iteration of the conveyor belt of brushfire wars that Xi of China is directing to destabilize the world and topple American dominance. So that's what's going on.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more about that, John. Two pieces of this that I want to tease out, though. One, to what extent is it obvious that Iran is engaged in this? We're hearing a lot about the Houthi rebels in Yemen. Who are these guys? What's their relationship with the Iranians? And is it anything other than, you know, sort of a means of disguising the actual Iranian involvement itself?
Yeah, the Houthis would not exist in Yemen if it wasn't for Iran. And this goes back to the 1950s. The Shah of Iran was actively engaged in this, driving Egypt and the United Arab Republic nations crazy. So there was a scuffling back then, and as the British attempt to withdraw from Yemen too. So this goes back many years, but the Houthis would not exist if it wasn't for Iran. And Iran is absolutely the direct action provocateur of China right now. So the Houthis seized a ship. It's really hard to keep track of these names because these names are constantly changing of these ships. But they seem to be Israeli related. The Galaxy Leader Houthis landed on. It was an empty car carrier. I'm just going by their film as their assault team went through the ship. The car carrier was empty. So they were seizing an empty car carrier. The landing of the Mi-17 helicopter was impressive because there was no landing deck. I suspect those were not Houthis flying that Mi-17. I suspect somebody else was flying those. I'm just going to withhold who I think it was. But that was some good flying. That was impressive flying for them to land with no deck, with a lot of obstructions.
This was used to insert a number of special forces kinds of personnel who ostensibly were Houthis, though. Is that right?
Yeah, who seized the ship. Also, the Zodiac Maritime, a belt carrier of product, was attacked. You have this large container ship, a mega container ship from CMA, but it's really unclear who's owning, operating, and what name it's. So it's really the Simi is one of the variations of the name, but that was attacked by drones over to the right in the upper Arabian Gulf. So a much broader operational area, and along the Houthis did that in the Red Sea. The Zodiac Maritime was in the Gulf of Aden. So this is a much broader operational area than the tanker wars of the 80s. So yeah. And
John, there was an involvement of a U.S. Navy destroyer in one of these assaults. It's a little unclear, at what point the Houthis decided to bug out, having taken command of the vessel briefly. Maybe it was when the cavalry was on its way. But talk a little bit about the involvement of that ship, our vessel, and what the Houthis did after it intervened.
Well, we've had multiple Arleigh Burke-class destroyers in the Red Sea making engagements on Houthi missiles, ballistic missiles fired from Yemen, ostensibly toward Israel. So they've shot those down. Most recently, there was a firing of ballistic missiles. Those are ones that go way up in space and come down, trying to hit. It doesn't even come close. They landed 10 miles away, but that was an oddity and a message in itself.
But trying to hit the Navy destroyer that had intervened.
Yeah. Yeah, and rightly, you don't want to expend your valuable missiles engaging when it's not going to even land close. They made the right call, not engaging that. That's expensive missiles you're cooking off to engage something. So what the Iranians are leveraging is a sparse and under-equipped U.S. Navy that can't be everywhere at once. We're still under 300 combat vessels. The plan to go to 355 is literally 30 years in the future. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. Reagan and the Lehman brothers are not satisfied with this. Secretary of the Navy during the Reagan days. And I know Chris well, and this is absolutely ridiculous. And we simply have an undersized Navy.
John, let me just get to the crux of the matter. Going back to what you said a moment ago about a guy I call a strategic arsonist, Xi Jinping, setting off these brush fires, if you will, mini conflagrations. Some of them are not so many. What he's done in Ukraine, for example, what has been going down with Hamas's invasion of Israel and its reaction. The concern, of course, is that these are now proliferating at a time when, as you say, our Navy in particular is inadequate. And do you think that the object of the exercise is simply to distract, deplete our resources, to maybe even just demoralize us in preparation for Xi Jinping's own aggression out in the Pacific?
Oh, absolutely. I think it has to be looked in this strategic context. There's no other way to look at it. And this is a place where the undersized Navy, which only has two types of ships, either an Arleigh Burke or a carrier. Okay, we have amphibious ships also. There's a lot of scuffling that's going on that I'm be labeled an apostate for saying this, where the littoral combat ships could be usable if they were properly equipped and deployed logically by big Navy. But they just that's a whole story in itself.
Well, it is. Most of them have, it seems, been proven unseaworthy, let alone adequately equipped. So it's a problem. There may be some other options. In fact, I want to visit with you about those on another occasion, John. But the main point is, if the Chinese have their way, excuse me, but the main point is, John, if the Chinese have their way, they could conceivably so deplete our capabilities, including quite possibly, I fear, with another fire set here inside the United States itself, that they may be able to get into Taiwan without fighting, as Sun Tzu would recommend. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I haven't checked on the latest location of the Reagan and the Carl Vinson. It appears we have two carriers at sea in the Western Pacific, but that's two. We used to have three or four simultaneously just in the Western Pacific at sea. So we have two over there, but the reality is the preponderance of operational forward deployed naval assets are in the Middle East, either the Mediterranean or the Red Sea, Gulf of Arabia, Persian Gulf. That is that is consuming our command and control and focus. And our National Security Council and apparatus is totally focused on negotiation of release of hostages in what's going on in Qatar, because that's where all the negotiations. So our National Security Advisor and staff they're all distracted, and that all serves Xi's purpose.
It does indeed. John Mills, we so appreciate your insights into all of this, and we'll be following, as you will, I know, closely what comes next in terms of these brush fires, if you will, or worse, real conflagrations. Thank you, my friend. Congratulations again on The War Against the Deep State, as well as your previous book, of course, The Nation Will Follow. God bless you. We'll talk with you again soon. Stay tuned for more, folks, right after this.
The
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. A new tanker war has erupted in the waters of the Middle East, with Iranian proxies attacking, seizing, and otherwise targeting vessels in the Red and Arabian Seas. The immediate object of such piracy, ostensibly carried out by Houthi rebels based in Yemen, is to endanger Israel-tied commercial shipping. These attacks, however, fit a pattern of calculated strategic arson being perpetrated elsewhere by Iran's sponsor, Chinese dictator Xi Jinping, as he prepares for a shooting war of his own. Notably, a U.S. destroyer that interrupted one such attack on Sunday subsequently had two Houthi ballistic missiles splashed down in her vicinity. The more our too-small navy is tied down half a world away from the Pacific, the better for a man who likely has more such depleting distractions in mind before he moves against Taiwan and us in the months to come. This is Frank Affney. Welcome back. And if ever there were a time for a genius to help us sort out what on earth is going on, not just in the Middle East, but particularly there at the moment, this is it. And fortunately, we have our duty genius on deck. His name is George Raceley. He always smiles tolerantly when I say this about him, but he's a member of the Mensa Society, and he is antithetically, I believe, fabulously thoughtful, smart, and skilled individual. We're always proud to have him with us. He is the editor-in-chief of a terrific online publication called Conservative HQ, Richard Viguerie's newsletter. He is also a member of our Committee on the Present Danger, China, which I'm very appreciative of, as well as a great friend and colleague. So, George, it's good to have you. As always, welcome back.
Thank you for that build-up, Frank. I'll try and live up to it.
You always do, unfailingly. So I want to talk to you about Israel. We've been talking with our previous guests about it in the Middle East more generally, but to some extent, but also specifically what's happening to the Jewish state at the moment. And I'd be very interested in your thoughts, George, the extent to which in particular the peril that Israel is facing seems to be growing by the day, in part as a result of the Biden administration's policies and conduct. And I think Ben Weingarten did a marvelous job of laying that out. But I'd be interested in your thoughts as well, as an astute political observer, among other things.
Well, the Biden administration is attempting to imposed what I call the new American way of war, which is to intentionally not win on our friends in Israel. And what we need to understand is that this is an existential battle for the survival of not only the Jewish state, but the Jewish people. And to the extent that Biden is attempting and apparently somewhat successfully to rein Netanyahu and his unity government in from actually going out and destroying their enemies. This is setting up a, you know, continuation of this slow bleed of the Israeli economy, the Israeli security situation, and the Jewish people's safety in the world. And so we have to understand what's really going on here. As I said, to, you know, to introduce this is in essence imposing the American no-win war philosophy on Israel.
You know, George, that's such an important insight. And the difference, as I think you've indicated, is we have had the luxury of losing wars at some great remove from us without, you know, it endangering the very country that we love and live in. Israel has no such luxury. It is cheek by jowl with people who are set on destroying it, and they're emboldened clearly by what's been happening here. I wanted to ask you about one particular angle on this that you've written about recently at Conservative HQ, namely the fact that I was astonished to discover, as I think a lot of us were, that on the 7th of October, Israelis basically had no means of self-defense when large numbers of them were attacked viciously by these jihadists. Presumably, since they had a lot of situational awareness about Israel and where they were going and what they were going to target, they knew that there were not guns in the homes of these Israelis that they sought to rape and, you know, mutilate and murder and take hostage. What's up with that? I thought Israel had more sense and made it a point of being armed and defended.
Yeah, unlike, for example, Switzerland, where the reservists take their weapons home with them, you know, Israeli defense forces at the various kibbutzes had weapons locked up in their armories, and the poor kids at the music festival had no arms at all other than a few lightly armed guards that were there really to keep the peace among the attendees, not to defend them from, you know, an army of jihadists. And so what really defined who lived and who died on that day was whether or not someone immediately grasped what was happening, got to the kibbutz armory, opened it, distributed the arms, and rallied the kibbutzim to defend themselves. And in a couple of notable cases, that happened, and the kibbutzim took no casualties or very light casualties and devastated the attackers. In others where there was not that immediate recognition, or the person who was responsible for opening the armory and distributing it was for some reason unavailable, those people lost their lives or were taken hostage. And of course, we know what happened at the music festival when literally hundreds of kids were killed, taken hostage, raped, tortured, all because they had no means of defense. And so we Americans ought to thank the good Lord and our founding fathers for their inclusion of the Second Amendment in our Constitution, which doesn't, the Second Amendment protects our right to self-defense. It doesn't grant it. We have a God-given right to self-defense, which the Israeli government stripped away from many of its citizens to their great cost.
That's the key point. And it's not something that I've heard a lot of discussion about, the circumstances, the pretext, the theory behind depriving them of their God-given right to self-defense. But it certainly is an object lesson for us, especially at a moment when I think we not only have the Biden administration champing at the bit to take our guns away, but they're trying to empower the World Health Organization to be able to do the same, which is a subject for another day's conversation. We're going to come back in a moment with more, with George Raceley, the executive editor of a wonderful online publication. You can find it at conservativehq.com. Welcome back. We're visiting with our friend George Raceley, the executive editor of Conservative HQ. He is also the go-to authority on a lot of matters involving political life. He has been involved in some 300 campaigns in the course of his career, from those for the presidency on down. And we always value his insights into what the so-called mundo politico is up to. And George, something that our friend Ben Weingarten spoke of earlier in the program was something I wanted to run by you too. And that is this phenomenon, the Chinese have a term for it. They call it elite capture. And in fact, it's prominently described in our book,
yes,
to which
is.
You have contributed, I'm happy to say, as a member of our committee on the present danger of China. In the indictment of the Chinese, they have made huge inroads in not just our political elite, but business and academia and the media and so on. Mm-hmm. It seems, as Ben mentioned, that that's true of the Sharia supremacists as well. Especially in our academic institutions and,
And
Detroit's suburb of Dearborn, for example. Talk a little bit about the nature of this phenomenon and the danger that it represents to our country.
Well, it's, in the case of the Red Chinese, it's driven largely by greed on the part of Americans who are easily swayed by Chinese money. And that's where, they've increased their influence exponentially in academia, for example, by granting millions of dollars to various colleges and universities. If you want to do business in the huge Chinese market and make a bunch of money, then you've got to play the game according to the Communist Party's rules. And, the case of the jihadists or Sharia supremacists, it's what I call, and I think what a lot of others call, intersectionality between the goals of Marxists and the goals of the Sharia supremacists to destroy Western civilization. And so you have a segment of American political elite who are all in for, the Marxist takeover of America and Western Europe, the end of democratic republics like the United States. And this is the so-called red-green axis that we've talked about many times before. And so...
So they may not completely align on the end state, but their immediate common interest is taking us out.
Exactly.
It's either one of them, right?
Yeah, and they'll happily make common cause and fight it out between themselves when we're eliminated. And so that's where this comes from, and it's been a goal of the Marxists to enlist the jihadists since the 1920s when Lenin and Trotsky had a big meeting of the peoples of the East tried to enlist them at that time, and nothing really immediately came of it. But what did come of it and has lasted for 100 years is this notion that there should be an alliance of, or there is an alliance of interests between Marxists and Islamists.
Mm-hmm. You might add into that mix what are now being called, I believe, black identity extremists, as well as globalists of the sort of World Economic Forum stripe, all of whom have a different model of what the world should be like than the present one, but they're happy to make common cause with each other against us, that's for sure. George, this brings me to a not unrelated question, which is the impact on elections that this kind of aligning of hostile forces represents. It's clear that in the past, the George Floyd related rioting, for example, had an impact on the 2020 elections. It's clear that the circumstances today are likely to have an impact on the 2024 presidential race as well. And that's before you even get to the issue of, you know, the difficulties with assuring election integrity. These are just forces that are able to exercise a certain dynamic that can undermine, you know, the election process. Could you talk briefly about how all of this is shaping up as you see it as a veteran political hand?
Well, there's a couple of things that come immediately to mind. One is that the Republican Party at the national level has failed completely and utterly to grasp that law and order is a fundamental issue in 2024. They failed to grasp that in 2020. They all, you know, hid when rioting and burning down cities and creating literally billions of dollars in damage to innocent people, including many black business owners, was cloaked in, you know, oh, well, if you oppose these riots, you're a racist. That's one piece of it. And so, you know, Republicans ought to be out there demanding law and order and an end to these Sharia supremacist riots on campus and even in public high schools, for goodness sake. Secondly, there is a huge disconnect between the Republican Party and the need for election integrity. And election integrity isn't just the notion that ballots can be stolen or misused, as has been disclosed almost daily, happened in 2020 and happened in elections since then. It's also the manipulation of perfectly legal things, for example, like spending public funds to turn out specific tranches of voters who will vote Democrat. And so, again, the Republicans have been, you know, completely inept in opposing those things.
It's critical that we get that fixed. George Raceley, come back to us with more details on how to do that. I hope the rest of you will come back to us next time. Until then, that you will go forth and multiply.